Welcome to Shattering News. Hi, I'm Yana. Our program is devoted for what some polls indicate is the largest segment of society, to those who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they're counterproductive, and they cannot be fixed. However, evangelical Christians did not get the bulletin. According to the poll reported by SRN News, evangelical Christians are going to vote in record numbers. They're interested in politics, and they're going to push the Republican candidates to victory. I have long said that in America, politics and religion are inseparable. Yes, Christians of the evangelical persuasion, most Protestant Christians, are conservative Republicans. Most Roman Catholic Christians are liberal. And when you get to the most popular religion in America, which is socialism, you will find that the overwhelming preponderance are extremely liberal. Religion and politics, they've always been intertwined, and there is nothing new now. Of course, we have been considering Pauline Christianity, and it was Paul's treatise on government in his acclaimed letter to the Romans that erroneously stated that God established governments and that Christians should submit to them. Now, of course, that is untrue. Paul lied. But that this integration between politics and the religion of Christianity has been cemented ever since. I noticed over the weekend that there was another upheaval in the world of political correctness. I am not a fan of political correctness. It interferes with free speech. And a individual whose life might have been dedicated to doing the best that they can do under for a particular group is then skewered because they say something in a tweet or on a post that others pick apart, typically out of context. A fellow who has been the president of the PGA, not the PGA Tour, but the PGA, just professional golf instructors and pros, the kind of guys that provide golf lessons and run pro shops at golf clubs. The man who was elected president of that organization, a man whose daughter makes a living in the golf industry. She is a collegiate coach for a girls' golf team. He spoke out against Ian Poulter. Ian Poulter is a very emotional fellow. Ian Poulter is an extravagant dresser. He's a guy who runs his own clothing line, and his apparel is, shall we say, flamboyant, as is his personality. He is a European golfer, a Brit, and he wrote a book where he spoke out about the Ryder Cup, where he has had some good performances. And this president of the American PGA took exception with some of the things that he said, particularly against seven-time major champion Tom Watson and the criticism he had for his own captain of a Ryder Cup team, Nick Faldo, who's a six-time major champion. And when Ian Poulter was being, probably belligerent, a little rude, a little aggressive, a little condescending in his book, this fellow just said, you know, the way it sounds is that you're crying like a little girl. Well, that's what he said. And because crying like a little girl was used to demean a grown man, he was summarily fired from his position and raked over the coals, completely dismissed. And it just strikes me, are girls smaller than men on average?
Yes.
Are girls typically, on average, more emotional than men?
Yes.
Are there exceptions? Sure. But is it a general rule that women have a tendency to be, particularly if you compare a little girl to a little boy, that women would be slightly more prone to emotional outbursts?
Absolutely.
Now, if women were not slightly smaller than men, then there would be no need for Title IX in universities. You know, the football team doesn't discriminate on the basis of sex, nor does the baseball team. The only discrimination based on sex are women's sports. And Title IX, which is a government mandate, forcing schools that if they have 150 scholarships for the football team, that they would have to have 150 scholarships for girly sports. It's silly, since there is no rule that says women can't play on men's teams. That just the football team, just the baseball team, just the basketball team. A woman is good enough, she can play. But typically women are smaller, so they don't. They have to have their own teams. No, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. But to force the school to have as many scholarships when the women's teams all lose money, that's not so good. It's inappropriate. Particularly since the men's football team makes so much money for most universities and pays for all of the other sports. But if women were not smaller, what would be the purpose of that? Men on the PGA Tour do not discriminate based on sex. Women have attempted to play on the PGA Tour. I think that one woman actually made the cut in a tournament. No woman has ever competed favorably and never been in contention on a men's tournament, but nonetheless, they want to play, they can. Men, of course, cannot play on the PGA, the women's PGA. But here's a fellow that was speaking to Ian Poulter and said, you know, you're crying like a little girl. And he was fired. And you can't have it both ways, women. You can't say that you have to have your own league and that women ought to be able to play on any men's tournament and men can't play in the women's tournament. And you need to have your own scholarships and your own teams in school, like the golf club knows if it's a female hand or a male hand that's swinging the club. You can't have it both ways. Either you are smaller and you need special treatment and you need to discriminate against men because you're smaller, or you ought to, if you're not, then do away with those benefits. And then you'd have a case against this fellow. You know, when I was growing up, one of the things that I was exposed to is manning up. I was male. I was expected to act like a male. There's differences between men and women. And today, we can provide privileges for the women, but we can't speak of the differences. What a stupid world we live in. So here's a man in sports fired for a line on Twitter against a very flamboyant and outspoken fellow who was overindulgent in his celebration. Says, cry like a little girl. Well, moving to more serious news, CNN is trying to do the same thing that the BBC is doing and the Washington Post is doing, and virtually every anti-Semitic periodical is doing, which is to present the deaths of two children as if there is an equivalency. We reported last week that a several-month-old little girl, an American, was deliberately run down by a Muslim man who was incited by his religion and by his political leader, the President Mahmoud Abbas of the PLO, to attack Jews in Jerusalem. and he deliberately ran in his car into a group of people that were waiting outside of a train station, injured a number of people, and murdered a little girl who was thrown some 100 feet in the air, landing on her head. The girl was an infant. Now, that is being equated to a Muslim boy in his early teens that was killed to prevent him from throwing bombs at police. The Muslim boy was rioting. He was holding and throwing explosive devices at Israelis. And he was killed in the process. These are not equivalencies. To combine them, which is what the world's media is doing, shows yet again that the world has lost its moral compass, that journalists are incapable of thinking, that we've reached a period of time where exercising good judgment is beyond the capacity of those who engage in what used to be a profession where judgment was critical to the performance. Journalism doesn't exist anymore. Now, universally, it talks about the slayings of Israeli and Palestinian teens as somehow being related. And, first of all, the Israeli who was killed was not a teen. She was less than a year old. And the Palestinian, unlike the Israeli girl that was just being held by her mother, the Muslim teenager was holding and then throwing Molotov cocktails. The loss of the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian, is not a loss to anyone, not a loss to the individual. His life was going to have no merit. He had been indoctrinated to hate, to kill. Was enraged and poisoned by the most deadly disease ever conceived by humankind, the religion of Islam. His life had no hope. He had been taught that it was appropriate by his parents to riot. He was killed rioting. I cannot feel any sympathy for the parents because they groomed him. They trained him to respond this way. They're celebrating his death. The loss of the Israeli infant is a tragedy. Taken cold-blooded murder. A Muslim man ramming his car into Israeli citizens who were just minding their business out in front of a train station. The murderer, poisoned by Islam, poisoned by the politics of the PLO, tragically took the life of an infant. And Israel is going to respond. Israel, which had committed to build thousands of homes in Jerusalem, their capital, is going to expedite those homes. I applaud Israel for the response. But I demean the media and politicians for equating that death to the death of a Muslim teenager who was shot and killed while throwing Molotov cocktails, engaged in riots. His parents celebrated his death, saying, "Oh, it's just not fair. He was, you know, the Molotov cocktail is no match for police shooting bullets. Police aren't going to shoot bullets if you're not throwing the Molotov cocktail." That's just the bottom line here. What right do you have to protest? The Muslims in Israel were treated better than Muslims are treated in any Islamic country, given better education, better health care, better economic opportunity, greater freedoms in terms of electing government and political officials. They were the freest, safest, most prosperous, best educated Muslims in the world. But Yasser Arafat of the PLO decided that that was not acceptable and that Israel had to be defeated and Jews all had to be driven into the sea to die. And so he began to use terrorism And this is the result. Now, if you want to make a connection between these things and say, oh boy, we need to somehow rein in those terrible, oppressive Israelis because they're killing little boys and girls, and we need to have a two-state solution. So you want to reward terrorism? Go ahead. That's your choice. Be a moron. Equate what happened in Gaza to Israeli terrorizing so-called mythical Palestinians. That fighting occurred because the Muslims couldn't be trusted. They had agreed that they would stop sending rockets into Israel, and they did so anyway. That's just the bottom line. They can't be trusted. They're enraged. They're belligerent. They're disgusting. And they brought the carnage on themselves. And they celebrate it. And the world responds by rewarding them, by lavishing them with enormous gifts of money and political accolades. It's disgusting. In Ramallah, of course, these mythical people known as the Palestinians are angry that the boy, 14, was killed while trying to riot. And so they're taking their grief to the streets. There's no grief. It's all fake. They're celebrating this. They're glad he's dead. The teen died in clashes in the town of Silwad, according to the U.S. State Department. The Israeli Defense Forces says the attack was prevented when the military fired upon a male hurling a Molotov cocktail on the main road during heavy traffic. He was trying to kill people. His father got on the plane. His father lives in America. Why we allow this, I do not know. But his father lives in New Orleans and feels that the odds were stacked against his son. His son was throwing a Molotov cocktail at drivers on a busy highway, trying to kill individuals, burn them alive in their cars. And the deck was stacked against his son. Good grief. Last week, the FEC in America deadlocked on a crucial internet campaign regarding free speech. The vote was announced on Friday. All of the GOP members voted against the restrictions. All of the Democrats voted in favor of the restrictions. What the Democrats are attempting to do with the internet is to control free speech. They want new rules where the government censors what can be posted and what cannot be posted. They also want to be able to charge organizations, to tax them for expressing views on the internet. The commission was deadlocked. Obviously, America is becoming more liberal. Guess what the FEC wants is that the government, particularly liberal politicians, want is to have everyone expressing political views online, whether they're written or verbal, to report and register with the government, to keep track of all of their records and expenses, and to submit them to the U.S. government. All about government control. The government wants absolute control over information. That way they can lie to people more effectively. One of the greatest scumbags ever to infect Washington, D.C. and the White House is Hillary Rotten Clinton. She's running for president of the United States. She told audiences at a campaign rally on Friday not to listen to anyone who says businesses create jobs. Don't let anyone tell you it's corporations and businesses that create jobs, Mrs. Clinton said during her remarks at a Boston rally for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Martha Coakley. You know the old theory, trickle-down economics, she said. That's been tried. That has failed. It has failed rather spectacularly. There is no hope for America, folks. None whatsoever.
especially when there are people that heard her say this, which is a blatant just...
disregard for reality.
Yeah, blatant disregard. They loved it. They clapped.
Oh, of course.
They all believed it. They all...
Yep, exactly.
So I would love to just ask her the question, who creates jobs then? Where do jobs come from? Why do we have jobs?
100% of productive jobs in America have been and continue to be created by businesses. Corporations have to be businesses. There's no reason to make a distinction between corporations and businesses. 100%. You see, government jobs are expenses. They're not. They don't produce income. They don't produce value. They consume value. The 100% of government is paid by business. It's either businesses paying business and corporate tax, businesses paying salaries, which businesses then is tasked with the responsibility of collecting and submitting the income tax on those individuals. Businesses paying all sorts of property tax and license tax. And then businesses paying duties on imports, and then businesses paying sales tax. Even when consumers pay their tax by whether it be property tax or personal income tax, all of that is created by business. Now, you could say, well, you know, government workers pay tax too. Yes, but the percentage that they're paying comes out of money that was spent based upon its contribution from business. It's just simply giving back some of what they spent. It's not income. It's expense. You know, business is the only thing. It's the only thing that has distanced America for a good long period of time from the rest of the world. If it were not for business and the free enterprise system, America would not be in any way distinguished from the rest of the world. It is what created the America that people enjoy today. But government is the hindrance of business. Government taxes business, which punishes success. It discourages people from engaging in business. Government regulates business, keeping them, making them less productive. Government sues business. They penalize business. They demean business. Government is a huge liability when it comes to business. And since all jobs are created as a result of business, even the government jobs, because it is business that is paying for those, when you make such a statement, you're not only saying that which is untrue, but the opposite is true. And she's saying, don't let anybody fool you that business creates any jobs. No, they create all jobs. All productive jobs are created by business. And yet, the government of the United States has become so aggressive against business through taxation and regulation that business is dying.
Well, it fits right in with everything even the president has said. He had his, you didn't build that. You didn't build that. You had to have roads going to the business. And the roads were created specifically because the company was building a building there.
I mean, if it wasn't for business, there would be no roads.
Well, there's no reason to go
government would, the government would have no means and no reason to do anything without business. Now, I'm not overstating this. Literally, the antithesis of what Hillary Rotten Clinton said is true. But it is that mentality that has destroyed America.
Well, it feeds into their whole thing of whatever you have, I have to have too. It's mine as well.
Oh,
I have some part in that.
Wealth redistribution.
Yeah, and that's what it fits into.
No responsibility. It's what causes so many people to think that they can steal. Because they're given benefits that they did not earn. You get 75 million Americans on food stamps? Good grief.
Well, how many?
You have an earned income tax credit. How is it earned? It's to diminish the amount of welfare. They came up with this scheme called an earned income tax credit. So rather than paying tax, the government pays you. I mean, We are so upside down as a nation. We have so disincentivized being productive and responsible and have so incentivized being irresponsible that we now have a majority of Americans who are irresponsible. And these Americans want to hear that these kinds of lies. By the way, there is no economic strategy called trickle-down. It's as stupid as Star Wars. There is absolutely no economic policy that has ever been tested, ever been tried, ever been conceived called trickle-down. That is just a political myth, and she knows it. There was a economic strategy that was deployed during Reagan's first term called supply-side economics. Supply-side economics said that there is a level of taxation over business which actually diminishes revenues and diminishes the economic prosperity. That if you overtax businesses, in America, overtax businesses, it's amongst the worst countries in the world in terms of its corporate and business tax, that if you overtax individuals and businesses, that you actually derive less income for the government, and that you diminish economic growth. You actually penalize success. And it's called supply-side economics. It says, so if you lower taxes on business, that you will increase overall economic viability and prosperity, and in the process, on lower rates, the government will take in more money. That was supply-side economics. A USC professor, University of Southern California professor, named Laffer, came up with this curve, which demonstrated this, based on his research. He was right. Reagan tried it. Not only did Reagan come into office during a time of great economic upheaval, where inflation, because we were inflating the amount of currency to try to stimulate the economy, was way out of whack. I mean, just way out of whack. We had inflation of 15, 16, 17, 18% per annum compounded. But also we were in a recession. And Ronald Reagan came in with the idea of supply-side economics. And while he did not decrease the amount of government spending, he did decrease taxation. And when he decreased taxation, for the next 16 years, actually 20 years, for the next 20 years, Americans enjoyed the economic reward of supply side. So we tried supply side, and we had 20 years of prosperity. All 8 years of the Reagan term, the 4 years of King George I, and the 4 years of Bill Clinton. As a matter of fact, at the end of supply-side economics, the government was actually generating a surplus. But, you know, politicians are politicians. American governance is counter to the American economy. You don't have business people that run for office. None of the individuals who have held that office are business individuals. You know, if you look at Ronald Reagan, he was an actor. You look at King George the first, he was a professional politician. You look at Bill Clinton, he was a professional politician. You look King George II was, I don't even know what you'd call him. But his only endeavors in business were completely failed, and they only existed because of his father's reputation. He was able to solicit large financial contributions from the bin Laden family and other OPECers, and he squandered it all. He was mostly a child of privilege from the political notoriety of his father. And then, of course, after that, you have Obama Nation, who's never worked a day in his life for a business. Hillary Clinton was a lawyer, did not work in business. You know, yes, lawyers are typically legal corporations, but lawyers don't create something of value. They are really a parasite on the business community. Lawyers typically exist because of, and the preponderance of corporate lawyers really exists to fend off, to protect businesses from government overreach. And so supply-side economics not only worked, it worked brilliantly. Trickle-down does not exist. Everything this woman said was wholly and completely untrue, and yet the vast majority of people listening to her believed her. Why? Because the majority of Americans now are net parasites. They don't contribute. They're paid. They're rewarded for being irresponsible and for playing Robin Hood. It's the reason democracies always fail. It is the tyranny of the majority over the minority. It is a system that has never succeeded over time and that will never succeed over time. Now, we have Glenn with us. I just clicked him in, and yet I hear the music. Glenn, if you'll stay with us, we'll get to you first thing in the next segment. This is Shattering Myths, and we're shattering one now, of the rotten one, Hillary Rotten Clinton. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn on the line talking about the government business, and I won't say alliance, although there is one in the military side of the equation, and there are numerous number of businesses that make money now on the government, but for the most part, the average business is penalized by government. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. Yeah, I didn't. I certainly didn't use the word alliance myself, but
no, you didn't.
Well,
no,
I mean,
you
look, there is some corporate welfare out there for the big guys. We, for example, under Obamacare, we see, you know, big corporations being given exemptions while the little guy entrepreneur has to follow all the rules. So, and there are a lot of major corporations that don't pay much of any taxes, like GE and stuff like that. So.
Oh, that's not true. GE is an enormous taxpayer. In fact, GE is probably the largest taxpayer in America. And this notion that GE doesn't pay any tax is a complete and utter myth.
Well,
that GE, for 2 years, lost so many billions of dollars in the U.S. government scheme that tried to get everybody to own houses with nothing down and with adjustable rate mortgages, that GE Capital lost billions of dollars, and the billions of dollars that GE Capital lost offset other income. And so for a couple of years, GE didn't pay as much corporate tax as it had previously, but GE has always paid tax, and sometimes they pay tax in the $10 billion area. This is an absolute complete lie.
Oh, all right. Well, even so, we see, well, certainly the bank bailouts are an example of, you know, corporate welfare that's, you know, government.
There is no such thing. There is no corporate welfare. That's also a lie. There is no corporate welfare. You know, even the bank bailout, the money that they gave to the banks, they put on a gazillion restrictions, and the banks had to pay it all back with interest, and did. And then on top of that, the government has gone in and fined most every bank in the many billions of dollars. There's no such thing as corporate welfare. That's another political myth.
That wasn't my main thing. What I really wanted to illustrate, you had spoken about the relationship, marketing relationship of with business, you know, being sort of a distinguishing factor. There's another nation that really, really illustrates the relationship of government and business. And that would be Germany. If you look at the recovery of Germany, some of the good things that happened prior to it being co-opted by fascism as the German economy bounced back after World War One, before, you know, so we've seen Germany under fascism. We've seen it recover amazingly, even with the draconian requirements of the Versailles Treaty and stuff like that. Then we saw it co-opted by fascism. After World War Two, we saw East Germany. We saw the fruit of Stalinist communism in East Germany, while democracy and you know, free trade across West Germany at Bergen. Yeah. And even when burdened with East Germany, when the wall came down, Germany became the, you know, productive powerhouse of Europe, and is now being leached by all the other nations of Europe because it's the ambitious and productive one.
You look at East Berlin and West Berlin, East Germany and West Germany. Same people, same overall opportunity, same education, same everything, except a different political establishment. One was total top control. The really would be trickle down, if you want trickle down, total and complete control at the top. Government mandated everything versus free enterprise. And political and economic liberty in the West. And when you compare the two, and I was a world traveler at the time that the Iron Curtain existed and had the opportunity to shuttle between East and West Berlin and between the Eastern European countries that were controlled by the Soviet Union versus the Western European countries. And the difference is night and day. I mean, just literally light and darkness, the difference. That, so we've had a referendum on Hillary Rotten Clinton's idea of government is the mother lode of all good things and creates all wealth and free enterprise. We've had that referendum, and the world has seen that referendum, and there isn't a single case where the referendum was prevailed on behalf of control. Now, there are short periods of time where you can create the illusion of wealth creation, as in fascist Germany in the build-up to World War II, but it all collapses.
Right. The drab grayness of Soviet era Russia and East Germany.
Oh, my. Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Soviet era Russia, from Leningrad to Siberia, and oh my God, it was a horrible place.